Hello and welcome back to the Firebreak. I say back because I assume that you've seen previous episodes, but if you haven't, then just welcome to the Firebreak. I'm Steve Wolf. The Firebreak is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new technology and tactics to fight the world's most destructive fires. I'm here today with Frank Carroll. And Frank, you've got the, I can't tell, have you got the gray hair to prove it or?
I used to, or
the no hair. We're featuring the same look.
Yeah, we are.
So we're both qualified to kind of comment maybe on, you know, what was it like firsthand experiencing seeing the first wildfire?
In my case?
I see
what you mean. yeah. Right after we laid down dirt.
Exactly. It was pretty good. Frank, tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into wildfire, how this became your passion and your practice.
Well, I was probably doomed to it. My father was a forest ranger, and he used to take me along to fight fire when I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And he'd hand me a hardline hose with a Forester nozzle, and my job was to beat down the flames in front of him so he could cut line with the shovel because he was a lone ranger.
So
I started fighting fire in 1972 with the Park Service in Tucson, Arizona, and then I was in a primary firefighter position as a hotshot squad boss and so on, and then served on Type 1 teams for 11 years. But was also a forest planner. I went into planning and public affairs and governmental affairs. And so there was all of this development of policy over the years in wildfire and prescribed fire and so on. And that's now come to a new evolution of wildfire use and widespread intentional burning. And so I've been here through the entire sort of development of current wildfire policy that began starting about 1970.
Okay, so you're thinking maybe like the pen was more powerful than the chainsaw.
Well, yeah. I used a lot of both, but yes, the troops on the ground do what we tell them to do,
right?
What the policies say, and so the people that are writing the policies are actually deciding what the Pulaski is going to do.
Okay. Yeah. The pen over the Pulaski.
That's right.
There you go. I was looking for a tool that started with a P. That should have been the obvious one.
Yeah.
So how has the policy changed? And we should trace the course of that, really, like going back to the Out by 10 and see how changes in policy have impacted both positively and negatively, you know, fuel accumulation and fire intensity.
That's a really interesting point because, as you know, the Forest Service was created in 1905 with the express purpose of conserving America's natural resources, water, wood, air, etc. And in 1910, we had the big blow in Idaho and Montana that burned maybe more than 3 million acres and killed 75 firefighters and,
wow.
Just a mess. And that's what led to the development of the 10 a.m. policy. And the point then was a 3 million acre fire was ridiculously destructive of some of the greatest old growth that this country had, white pine and all kinds of stuff. And the nation decided that wasn't okay. We don't want to burn down our public resource, we need to build houses. And so the 10 a.m. policy started, put every fire out by 10 a.m. the following day was the policy right up until about 1970.
Wow.
Actually beyond 1970, but in 1970 in Yellowstone, a guy named Les Gunzel started letting fires burn. Everybody hates that term, but that's what you do. A lightning strike happens and you monitor it, which is the same thing as letting it burn.
Which, yeah, I guess the positive spin would be called, natural fuel reduction.
Fine, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But that's what we did. We were no longer in the 10 a.m. Now we were letting them burn. And over the next decades, we were still quite successful at suppressing big fires, but getting less so as time went on. And then after the Los Alamos fire in 2000, and then the Biscuit fire in Oregon in 2002, our people started hitting on this idea of, well, if a little fire is good, maybe a lot of fire is better. And there was some practicality with that because, you know, we only had maybe 30,000 firefighters total in the system in any given fire season. And so, you know, maybe we could conserve resources by doing something differently. But none of the new policy, which is a wildfire use policy, which says that line officers in charge of fires can make some kind of determination under the rubric of full fire suppression. They can let it burn, monitor, you know, corral pieces of it, contain a little bit of it, you know, herd it around, or light fire. This last summer, there was a firing operation that covered 40 miles.
Wow.
The Dixie Fire was 60% lit by firefighters. So 600,000 acres of the Dixie Fire was lit by firefighters on purpose for various reasons. And I want to circle back then to 1910. The massive destruction that caused us to decide to put fires out by 10 a.m., in 1910 is happening again, only now nobody's apologizing for it, but the destruction is the same. So, you know, the Forest Service in particular, but also the Park Service, have posed this idea, this policy idea, that reintroducing fire to the system as it did, you know, 250 years ago is a great idea. Let's get it done. The problem is when they do that, they're burning private property and public resources, and they have no mechanism for anybody to object or to try to stop it or to, you know, to help themselves to get compensation for the damage that's done. The Pole Creek Fire in Utah in 2018 started out as a smoldering log, and firefighters got to it and it was raining, and the forest supervisor decided to let it burn, and it ended up burning more than 120,000 acres and burning buildings and, you know, property and
no accountability.
And there's no accountability. They didn't have to pay for the decision. And so there's many lawsuits going forward about this issue and so on. But that's the genesis of the policy. And part of it is a surrender. We've surrendered to kind of a helpless position where we say, well, it's climate change. There's nothing that can be done about it. But when firefighters are lighting 600,000 acres on purpose, that's not climate change. That's a policy to use fire to manage natural resources. And, you know, if you like old trees like sequoias and redwoods, running fire through those big groves has killed 20% of the sequoias.
Wow.
And so we think it's bad policy. And we're trying to change it, and there's going to be a huge change coming, and maybe I'll get into that later, but this summer the Supreme Court will overthrow the policy that allows that to proceed, and there'll have to be a lot more thoughtful conversations and room for people to object and a place for people to get compensation when the Forest Service makes a decision like that.
Do you think there's any aspect of a generational gap between people who are making policy now and people who've been around long enough to see the impacts of different policies and bring more helpful perspectives?
There is a big gap. And what we say in government agencies is when you retire, you become irrelevant. But the problem with that is all of that institutional knowledge,
yep,
that you carry with you, and that you, you know, most of my peers who retired about the same time I did, or, you know, been out for a while, lose touch with the agency and its policies and development and so on. I don't, because I'm still actively engaged in wildfire, aspects of wildfire forensics and so on. And so in fact, I have a more comprehensive knowledge about wildfire policy now and practice than I ever did when I was in the government, because I'm able to look in detail at all these big pictures around the country, whereas people inside the agency are only focused on their local unit. So, yeah, there is a big missing piece of that. In fact, I sent a note to a friend of mine this morning who's a regional forester, and I told her that I thought that, you know, things are going to really change and we're going to have a pretty tough conversation coming up starting at the end of next summer. And I look forward to that. I hope that we can all do that, because something's got to change. We cannot burn back better.
Right. Right. Maybe we could build back better, but we can't burn back better. No, that's really great. So you're talking about it as a conversation that'll be had, and in a conversation, there'll be, you know, a variety of opinions and experiences. Let's say this wasn't a conversation though, Frank. Let's say that just was Frank's pen will become the policy. So if you were the god of fire policy, what would it look like?
There would be so that's complicated for a couple reasons, but I'll answer it. There's only one pot of money available to federal agencies for fire suppression, appropriated dollars from Congress, and that money for the Forest Service is called WFM, Wildfire Management, and its express purpose is emergency fire suppression. And so technically, and probably in fact, when the Forest Service changes emergency fire suppression to mean we're going to let the fire burn and spend months and thousands of firefighters herding it around and lighting more fire, that's probably a misappropriation of congressional funds. So the first part would be to come up with some kind of new legislation that makes allowances for these actual expenditures as opposed to, misappropriations. The second piece would be a comprehensive disclosure of the environmental impacts of these wildfire policies across the country. How many acres have we burned to the ground? How much old growth have we lost? What's the real story about impacts on clean water, clean air, flooding, private property losses? So a secondary piece of that would be the ability for people to get compensation when the Forest Service or Park Service, whoever, makes a decision to do something other than put a fire out and their property is damaged or burned. And I think I'll stop there for right now, and maybe we can keep talking and I'll think about that a little bit. But those are the, you know, it's very complex, but there's some simple things we could do that would, you know, if forest supervisors and park service superintendents knew that their decision may result in millions of dollars in damages, maybe hundreds of millions in damages to private property, they might make a little bit different decisions.
Yeah, especially if there was accountability, right? Financial accountability from the agency and perhaps in some case, even at the individual level. You know, I believe in New Mexico, right? There was consideration of charges being brought.
So New Mexico was really interesting. We worked down on those fires quite a bit the last 2 years. And there was an immense pressure on the forest supervisor to light that fire and make those acres. Whether it's a wildfire, prescribed fire, or whatever, at the end of the year, the Forest Service counts all of those acres as fuel treatment. Acres of fuels treated. And what that means is that a barn burning fire that just, you know, takes out everything for 180,000 acres in one afternoon, like the North Complex near Oroville, is counted as fuel treatment, but it's not really fuel treatment.
No.
It didn't, you know, burn out the underbrush and save the big trees and so on. It wiped out everything. We think it's ridiculous that should be called fuel treatment. Yes, it was fuel treatment, but it's not acceptable.
Right. Not in any way.
No. And so, those are the, you know, those are some of the things that are happening. And in New Mexico, the agency doubled their sin, as it were. They started the fire. In fact, they started three fires. There was one on the other side of the Santa Fe that was like 45,000 acres. And then the Calf Canyon and Hermit's Peak, two fires burned together. And then every day the agency went down and lit private property on fire, burned people's houses down, burned barns and, you know, riparian zones, and which resulted in July of that year, July of 2022, their burning resulted in the deaths of three people. When a rainstorm hit a badly burned drainage and came down and killed people in their cabin. So these are hugely consequential decisions with absolutely zero accountability.
So obviously nobody makes those decisions with those outcomes in mind. What type of data or predictive modeling would be helpful to the people who have to make those decisions in allowing them to better anticipate the consequences of any given prescribed burn?
So that's kind of the golden fleece in the world. Is there a mechanical or an AI or some device that would let us to divine what's going to happen next? And I think that may be way more complicated than landing one of Elon Musk's big boring machines on Mars and creating a city and the underground. And the reason I say that is because ask the question again.
is you know, what type of predictive tools would allow, you know, a burn boss to be able to see or anticipate what the consequences of any given, you know, burn might be?
So in my experience, I've been through many iterations of tools, from pre-planning resources, figuring out where the closest resource is that can, attack any fire in a location, to now these high-tech companies working on instant discovery of fires as soon as they're, you know, as small as a meter across and so on. Or the first signs of smoke, the cameras pick them up, or the satellites pick them up. And none of those things help answer really essential questions, and they don't really affect outcomes. An example is we can now find fires at, you know, almost real time speed. But what if the policy of the agency where the fire is burning is to let it burn? What's the point of having picked it up immediately?
Right.
If people on the outside of the fire agencies who don't understand policy considerations think that, man, if we can just find it really fast, that's going to be the thing, and they'll run out there and put it out. But that's not what they're doing.
Yeah. And even if they wanted to, you know, knowing about it doesn't necessarily give you the tool to do it, right? Having cameras all around your house doesn't make you any better prepared to deal with, you know, a home invasion, unless you've got a tool that can handle those people.
An M4 Benelli shotgun, semi-auto. That's what,
you know, I go with the M4 as well.
It's a good gun.
And I like the Remington 870.
Yeah, me too. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is fire is so complex. I remember when Lucasfilms hired the guy that discovered fractal geometry.
Yes.
And fractal geometry allowed them to recreate planets and
modeling any surface.
Anything, right?
Yep.
And that was a huge breakthrough. And maybe there's something like that that's out there that can help us with fire. But think of all the factors that would have to come together, all of the immediate local weather that's affecting the fire, the terrain, the heat of the soil, the fuel moisture of the vegetation.
Right.
Amazing. And so what agencies are doing now, in my experience, is they're using those things as kind of a shield. they're picking a policy. Let's say that the policy is we're going to let a lot of them burn. In fact, we're going to enhance them. We're going to go light miles more fire. And that's our policy. And so I take my predictive tools like WFDS, the Wildfire Decision Support System tool, that helps them, you know, figure out what decision they're going to make. And then they, you know, they have these management action points, maps, they call it, and so on, where they're going to take this action or that action. And so, you know, we're going to let it burn until it hits this action point, and then we're going to put in a line over here, but not over here. And right. So they're using those tools that they have now as a kind of a veil, a smoke screen.
I see.
Because yes, they help the predictive, you know, the fire behavior officer. I used to tease our fire behavior people. I told them, why don't you put on a deer skin with a bunch of bones in a pot, throw them on the ground, and just make a prognostication.
Is that actually better than the tea leaf model?
I don't know, but it's really dramatic. Yeah, right. Firefighters like deer skins.
Okay.
So, yeah, so, but no, there are valuable tools that help a lot, but not really in the end. The simple stated policies of things like five alternative approaches to wildfire, make those decisions, give those decisions absolutely to the handful of people that are standing there on the ground at the time. Hotshot crews are doing a lot of this burning on their own volition.
Well, without regard to public versus private versus BLM versus whatever, right?
Not at all.
Let's go lights.
There's new to us. There's not a single old firefighter like pre, I don't know, maybe 2000, 2005, who can believe that the United States government would say that there's a fire that's in country that's too steep, too rough, too hard, which is what they're doing now. And crews are refusing assignments based on whether they think it's safe, partly based on how the agency makes those judgments, like the Tamarack fire. It was a little lightning fire that was messing around in a open rock situation, perfect for smoke jumpers. We have smoke jumpers so that they can go into those too rough, too steep fires. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And the agency decided, because of the ecological pressure inside the agency to get burn acres, they're now calling watershed fire sheds. You know, that's where it's going. And so the agency decided to let it burn 70,000 acres in a couple of communities. And, you know, and so again, there's no accountability for this. And so things have got to change, and it's going to be a tough year. This year is going to be a tough year for the government. There are going to be multiple lawsuits at the end of the summer based on the Chevron deference being overturned by the Supreme Court that'll force them back to the table.
Interesting. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. You know, I know that they convened a you know, a wildfire, you know, Supreme Commission last year to do research and come back with recommendations. And right in the title of that the opening description of what they were doing, I took note to the word consensus. Right, this was going to be a general consensus of what the best way to handle, you know, wildfires going forward would be. And consensus is always going to be influenced by the zeitgeist of the time, and not necessarily that of temporal perspective. So if everyone thinks, you know, today, because something that happened on the news last week, oh, well, this is clearly the direction of the future, you know, then you get consensus. Just like 100 years ago, if we were to ask doctors what the best way to treat your wife's back injury is, you know, they 100% get leeches. That's it. We all know. Right. But I don't think that consensus necessarily gives you the right answer. It just gives you the one that the most people agree on.
Especially if you pick 50 people, none of whom think that anything's broken.
Yeah. Right. So
I mean, Admiral Kimmel would have been glad to have this committee in Hawaii. They would have all perfectly agreed with him. And the famous story about that in groupthink is Kimmel would invite new officers he was thinking about bringing into the command there in the Pacific to dinner, and they'd come to dinner, and if they salted their food before tasting it, he wouldn't take them.
Interesting. Okay.
Crazy. Yeah, that's what led to everything getting sunk, all the battleships lined up in a row to be sitting ducks. Same with the Air Force at that time. So, yeah, that's what that committee's doing for us. Nothing important at this point, in my opinion. So, they're absolutely not, you know, the 800-pound elephant in the room, the gorilla, where is the accountability in these decisions that are so profoundly impactful on people's lives, property, homes, businesses, health, the smoke problem?
Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera. Where's the accountability? There is none, and there's nobody on this committee arguing for that.
Very, you know, when I saw this, you know, the smoke coming down and impacting 120 million Americans out of Canada, you know, my first thought was, you know, Canada's inability to keep its smoke to itself. Right. That, you know, more than 100 million people health are going to be impacted because of whatever decisions, policies, aptitudes, or inabilities their fire management teams have. And again, no accountability, right? If I can't breathe and I go outside and I suffer a horrible asthma attack, you know, I can't sue the Canadian government because they decided to only have 2,000 firefighters on standby.
Plus, we only have their word that this is a good policy. With no accountability comes also, they've got wonderful writers. I wrote for them for 30 years. And their PR people, and their PR people said, man, you know, reintroducing fire like this in red flag conditions in high summer on these giant fires like the Dixie and the Thomas and the North and the August complexes and so on, is great for everything. There's no science. There's no disclosed environmental impacts. There's no recalculating forest plans to understand how that's affecting available sale quantity of timber. There's no study of riparian zones to see how that's wiping out the very things they're trying to protect, like little fly catchers in Arizona and so on. It's just this, it's an absurd assertion on behalf of these agencies with no foundation and no discussion.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a way to get an optimal outcome.
To get
a whole bunch of people who all think the same, have the same experience, and or possibly more accurately the same inexperience, and not be, you know, not be turning forwards and backwards to say, like, you know, where does this point in time fall in perspective with what we've learned previously and with our ability to anticipate the future using better technology.
And no team of elders who remember what it was like.
Right.
My dad used to laugh because every time the news came on in a big fire, there was somebody, spokesman for the fire community, would stand up and say, man, we're witnessing fire behavior we've never seen before. This is crazy. Climate change, or whatever it was, right?
Yeah, right.
And they were saying the same thing in 1910.
Yeah, right. Nothing
and there's changed. There's no cultural memory, and there's nobody to stand up and speak about those things, and there's no way to merge these zeitgeist, if you will, of the various times together to try to come to some understanding of whether or not what we're doing is actually rational.
They're starting to give a little bit of credence to that, but they not in a domestic way. They're saying, you know, well, maybe the Native Americans have some wisdom from hundreds of years of working with fire, or the Aboriginal tribes. And so they're actually starting to bring in some of those folks who have, ancestral wisdom about fire management. But you've got to take all of what they say, not just some of what they say. You can't say, right, that ancestrally, you know, Native Americans or Aboriginals, you know, they burned, so we're going to burn. No, they knew what to burn, when to burn, how to keep the flame heights, appropriately low, so that those burns were safe and, you know, had minimal impact other than actual fuel reduction, not neighborhood destruction.
That knowledge has some importance for us, I think. But in general, there was never a time like this where there were, I don't know, 13 million homes sitting in the ground that they used to burn every year.
Yeah.
What we call fuel model X. How do you, you know, how do you account for that if you're using open burning, broadcast burning, and so on? I mean, I grew up, the way we took care of the lawn in the spring was we didn't go buy fertilizer. Dad went outside and I went with him and we threw wooden matches all around and lit the grass on fire. And in a week it was greened up like crazy. Mom was upset because the dog had dragged in the ash, but you know, that's a really important point. Fire's important.
When I lived in Texas, I'd burn off my lawn, you know, several times a year. Whenever it started to brown up, I'd, you know, throw a match on the ground, burn it off. And yes, like you said, it would come back beautiful. I live in Colorado now, and that would probably land me 10 to 15 years in jail.
You live in Boulder, Colorado. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
That's different from Colorado.
No, you're right. You're right. Boulder is to Colorado as Austin is to Texas, as Berkeley is to California, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I grew up there in part. My grandparents lived there for 35 years.
Right. So apparently getting elected to City Hall doesn't necessarily impart wisdom.
What?
Just power.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, Frank, you've got obviously a ton of wisdom. We should do a documentary on you or a series of books by you. You know, if that work's not already in the works, and I want to have you back on the show so we can discuss more of this. But I think that the perspective, the temporal perspective that you bring, you know, having started this, you know, this career really at six and learning it from your dad who brought, you know, additional decades of experience is really invaluable to this conversation. And I don't think that there should be serious conversations about this topic without the types of perspectives that you bring. So I want to thank so much for joining me today. I hope you'll come back and we'll continue this conversation soon.
I'd be delighted to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Frank. All right, folks, this is another episode in the can of The Fire Break. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us this morning and learning a little bit about the perspectives of fire through the ages. And as usual, The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative techniques and technologies for dealing with the world's most destructive fires. Thanks for joining us here. We'll see you on the next show. Take care.